Dressing Observer Radio with Garrett and Dave, and our special guest, who was recently voted the Luthez Ric Flair Wrestler of the Year by Wrestling Observer newsletter readers for the second time in 4 years, Kenny Omega. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you so much for having me today.
So I guess I'll pass this off to Dave in a second, but the first question I wanted to know, and I imagine a lot of the listeners want to know, is just basically how you're feeling. You take some time off for injuries just wondering if, you know, are we going to see you back wrestling sooner than later?
The plan, of course, and I was perhaps a little too optimistic. I was hoping to be back by February, it's not looking that way anymore. And that's not to say that there was a huge snag or that, you know, there's something that is terribly wrong. It's not that. It's just when you're trying to get appointments and things fixed, you have it in your brain that, oh yeah, I could just call a number and I'll get in the next day. Unfortunately, there are sometimes waiting lists or there are other complications which create follow-up appointments and things like that. So unfortunately, and of course, you know, there's like the whole COVID thing as well, which just backed everything up by, you know, a good 2 weeks or so. And then that caused me to miss appointments, which then caused me to have to rebook. And then that extends the time again. It's just that part of the recovery process is always really poopy right now, but, it's still on track. I'm still feeling a little bit better, as time goes by. And that's without even having to do, a lot of the major procedures that I need to be done. That's just, myself working with, trainers and doing the proper rehab to strengthen surrounding areas of the injured areas of the body. And I guess one of the big takeaways from my training lately is that I was leaning too heavily into my strengths as a performer and as an athlete. And I guess over the years, there were either just natural strengths that I had or things that I had overdeveloped, and I was relying too much on those things. And now that, you know, the knees are gone, the neck's going, you know, I lose power in my rights. A lot of stuff is what's going on. It's like, how do you compensate for that stuff? And what is it that I can strengthen around those areas that can create a more stable and strong body? And it's like a silly process. And I always laugh at myself to see that, wow, as strong as, you know, this thing was, this thing that was adjacent to it was terribly weak, and I feel really pathetic. So it's been a process, but it feels good to kind of learn from the ground up these new movements that help correct issues that would have otherwise been completely debilitating. So it's going well. The training is going well, and once I actually am able to try to get the knees fixed, get the neck fixed, you know the hernia and all that stuff, hopefully I'm able to move around much better than I was before. And I guess kind of look like a guy that was doing what he was doing 10 years ago. Hopefully. That's always a hope. Fingers crossed.
One more thing, Dave, before we throw it to you. I had, this has probably been 10 years now. I had knee surgery. And I remember going through the rehab process, the physical therapy, and they would say, okay, now, you know, flex your quad, and I want you to make that muscle move. And I would try to make that muscle move, and they're like, nope, you're making the one on the other side move. And because of the injury, like you said, you know, there was an over dependence on certain muscles in the leg and an underdevelopment on other muscles in the leg, and then learning how to sort of walk correctly again, because if you've had injuries, you create this gait that's a limp, and then it turns into sort of your normal walk. So all of those things are very clear in my memory for what you just said. And I guess the follow-up to that is there any small thing that we all take for granted that because of your injuries that it was sort of hard to kind of redevelop or get back to how you used to do it before you got injured?
I mean, my normal walk now is kind of like a zombie shuffle. So as days go by, you don't realize how your daily activities and your normal lifestyle changes, unless you have someone actually pointed out to you that really knows the human body and its mechanics. Much like your situation that you just talked about, I would work with a trainer and someone who's, you know, very studied in human anatomy and all that. And it's like, you know, do this, flex only this, now flex this and this together. And you can't, it's like, my body couldn't make those connections anymore. And I was like, wait a minute, like, what's going on? Like, why is it my glute is completely dead? Why won't my glute actually fire? Why can't I, on command, activate my hamstring muscle? It's things like that. And it's alarming at first because it's like, whoa, like I've been that quad heavy for this long because, you know, my knee was in pain and I was trying to compensate in this way. And so, you know, I've been putting too much of my pressure on like my toes and the balls of my feet rather than absorbing any of that impact in the glutes and the hammies and sitting back in my heels at all. So it's things like that where I've been putting far, far too much impact on the things that actually were hurting because they hurt. And I thought I was actually cushioning them properly. But for me in the moment, that's how my body would react just to get through it and to try to kind of continue the facade that Kenny Omega was 100% when he wasn't anywhere close to it.
So now when it, and now have you, okay. So of the injuries, okay. So we know you had the hernia, nose injury, right? Shoulder.
Oh, yep.
Knees, of course, as you mentioned, is that the list of it or is there actually more?
No, that generally, those are like the big ones. Like for me, and I'm a very mobile and explosive wrestler. At least I like to be. I feel like I sort of went all in on having that explosivity to what I do in the ring. So for me, even if I have a hernia or like a shoulder injury, like I'm not, power wrestler. I don't really have an interest in being like a huge kind of power fighter in the ring, but I do always want to kind of be mobile. And I feel like even if I can't be the exact version of myself that I've brought to the table for X amount of years, you know, I still want to be somebody known for their dynamic ability in the ring and someone who's got good stamina in the ring. And it's tough because when the wheels go away, it's really hard to stay on top of your game from a cardio aspect. It's hard to figure out ways, how do I keep my conditioning up now? Because if I can't use my legs, you have to get real creative. And I've learned a lot on battle ropes, aerodyne bikes, you know, like weird things. I never would. This is the most bear crawling I've ever done in my life. I hate it. And it's just so just drastically different from what I would normally do for my conditioning. Cause I dislike being on treadmills. I dislike being on a machine where you're in one place, you're not seeing anything, nothing's changing. And all you can watch is just a clock, tick down or tick up to the goal. I like doing, I love, you know, running on a beach. I love, running on unstable surfaces, whether it be sand, you know, elevation changes, all that. And I like seeing the sights and the sounds around me. I like seeing, you know, animals, nature, all those things. And if I have those things around me, you know, a lot of time passes by and it's like, oh, wow, I've been outside running around for over an hour now. And it's fantastic. You know, I love playing basketball, beach volleyball, things like that. And I'm really competitive. So before I know it, I've been trying really hard and pushing myself more than I would have in just a one-on-one training scenario, because I just don't like to lose. But then when you really can't do anything and it's back to square one, you really do have to find you have to make fun out of some of the boring aspects or painful aspects of rehabbing. And that's sort of been the tough part, was to build up that mental fortitude again, where it's like, oh, this is why I'd rather train through sport than just train. And it's getting better though. I mean, as long as you stick to it, it becomes part of your habit, becomes part of your daily activity. And although I can't say that I enjoy my training, I look forward to it because I see improvements every day. And that in itself becomes sort of the reward. And hopefully the big reward in the end is coming back and being able to wrestle in a healthier state.
Now, how hard was it, you know, especially, you know, towards, you know, all through last year, because you were hurting at the start of the year too, but I mean,
Yeah.
But going through the whole year where you were, you know, you were in a position of having to do a lot of main events and you have a very unique pride in your work. in the sense that good isn't good enough. It has to be great. And, you know, you just the last match, I mean, you were going hard for a year. Then the November match with Hangman was, you know, you were put in a position to put him over big and you know, to make it a classic match. It was one of the best matches of the year. While you were at the same time, probably shouldn't have been wrestling. I mean, how painful was that? And how difficult was the year, really?
I mean, it's the difficult part is, you know, I'm kind of a very private person, and I'll always, of course, tell my friends, tell everyone in AEW, the people that I work with, you know, these are sort of my current limitations, or this is what's hurting on me. I still do know what I can do and what needs to be done. And I guess the tough part was just trying to, I don't want this to come out the wrong way, but I guess I wanted to fool the fans. I didn't want them ever to think Kenny's doing a decent job for someone that's hurt. I didn't even want that to cross their minds. I wanted to build myself up as a champion that they wanted to see defeated. And there were times, you know, when I was more difficult than others. I remember there was times, it's a funny story actually, when I was at Impact and when my hernia got real, real bad, we had to do did a lot of tapings when it was, no fan arena setting in Nashville. And I would be on every week doing something, whether it was showing up at the arena or, you know, walking out to the ring to cut a little bit of a promo or to interfere in a match. I wouldn't necessarily have a match all the time, but it got to a point where I would do some six-man tag for an app special. Then I would do another six-man tag for one of the TV shows, another tag match. And then, you know, the next day would be the pay-per-view match. And then the day after that would be the follow-up TV tapings to like the pay-per-view fallout. And those days would normally have maybe one match, but a lot of run-ins, a lot of interviews, a lot of promos. And I recall having to do a run-in. I think it was on Sami Callihan or maybe on Moose, or both actually. And every step felt like I was getting like poked in the stomach with some sort of sharp object. And remember Scott telling me after, he's like, Kenny, we had to just cut that entire segment out. It's like, you look like a 95-year-old man walking to the ring. I was like, well, yeah, like it was bad. So I couldn't do a run and I had to do like a walk in, but it was like kind of like the hot coals kind of walk where it's like, and I just couldn't, there was no more adrenaline left. Like I couldn't just rev up the tank and go, okay, the adrenaline's going, I can do these 8 run ins. Like you can't go up and down that many times in a day. And it was just came to a point where it's all I could feel was the pain and that's it. And I was like, wow, like this is getting bad. So, you know, I kept everyone in the loop about it. I'd mentioned it to Impact. I'd mentioned it to Tony. I said, like, hey, like I can get myself there and I can do what we need to do, but I really need to pace myself. I need to kind of really select those moments when I push it. Because if I do it all the time, then I'll never be able to get to a point where I can even do that. And Impact was super professional, loved working with them. And of course, Tony is super understanding about everyone's health and all that sort of stuff. Incredible boss and cares about us legitimately. And we were able to come up with a schedule and a way for me to be active all the time, but for me not to look the way that I did that 1 week on Impact.
So now as far as going forward, are you going to have surgeries or are you just going to rehab for a couple of months, or do you kind of know like what's kind of like in your short and long-term future?
Yeah. So the hernia is absolutely something that I want to get taken care of now. The last thing I want to do is, and some of the doctors kind of tell me like, hey, like you have the umbilical hernia. It's going to get real bad eventually, and you're going to have to get it taken care of, but you could let it rip for now. And I would hate to come back and let's say something happens where it just tears wide open and my intestines are spilling out everywhere. It would suck to come to take all this time off, come back and then immediately go, oh, actually, no, I'm going to get this other surgery now. I want to get it done now. Which, you know, that's a, to be able to walk around and live life, that's like a, you know, 5-day process or something like that. But to be able to, you know, take impact on the abdomen area, to miss like a moonsault, to get double foot stomped, things like that, you know, that's going to take 6 to 8 weeks probably before I should be doing it or before I would get cleared to do it. Maybe, I don't know, my healing factor would kick in and it would be quicker. I don't know, but you got to listen to the doctors at that point. And actually, as of right now, I think that's going to be the longest recovery time that I have to deal with. So as soon as I can get that taken care of, once that 8 weeks is up, that's probably going to be about the time when I'm able to make my return. And in the interim, I've got various knee treatments coming up, and some of them are pretty cutting edge. I don't even know if I can really talk about it, but real cool experimental stuff.
Have you tried stem cell stuff or anything like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a huge believer of stem cells and PRP. And, there are some treatments that are even, on top of that, that I'll be, investigating, that should really help. Or at least I'm optimistic about them helping. And, I think once, and that's why I say, hopefully when I come back, you know, it'll be more of a pain-free, you know, I won't have to kind of put myself in some sort of heightened mental state to be able to block out the pain receptors. I'll be able to just do focus on the match and the performance. And, that would be great because I haven't had that in a long time.
As far as like everyday life, you know, besides mm-hmm. when you're doing rehab and everything like that, are you cool? Like, cause you know, like sometimes when, you know, you've been through this and we, you know, we all have, but obviously not at your level, but you know, where something happens and you get the injury and then you, the injury when you can't sleep, you know what I mean? The pain when you can't sleep.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's like, to me, like with, that's the period where you're legitimately miserable. I mean, and just, it's just not fun. Okay. But when you, you know, when you're in pain walking, you can kind of deal with pain walking, you know, your knee hurts a little, your hip hurts a little, or whatever, mm-hmm. like that. You know, your shoulder hurts when someone rolls on it or something. I mean, that's like everyday, you know, life. I mean, that's okay. But it's like, to me, I always know, like when it comes to the point where I can't sleep, now I'm like, you know, now it's like miserable pain.
Yeah, and it works mentally, psychologically.
Are you past that, or are you still kind of in that state?
No, I'm absolutely past that. You know, there are times when, you know, I need a little bit of extra help to get to bed and maintain a sleep schedule. But you know, there were moments when I would legitimately worry, and I had this back in Japan too, where I was like, man, like I can't just take melatonin and go to sleep now. Like the pain in my shoulder or my neck is too much. And I remember when I had my hernia in my neck and it was at its peak worst condition. And that was the only time I'd ever taken time off from New Japan. I remember I had to take a Best of the Super Juniors off. I had to, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but it really was what it was. I was just so desperate to get any kind of rest. I would go on my stomach on the bed and hang my head down off the bedside, straight down. Just so I would feel a little bit of separation in my spine, and I would sleep upside down, and until I would wake up like 5 to 10 minutes later, being like all dizzy, like I was held up in a Davey Boy Smith vertical suplex. You know what I mean? So it was miserable. Like you said, it was like, it's no matter how, what you take, what you do, your massage doesn't work at that point. I remember I had to go to the top spine doctor in all of Tokyo, and he's a genius and one of the top in his field in all of the world. He had to give me some serious medication, stuff that would actually block like the pain receptors from nerve damage. And that was the only time when I could actually sort of live normally, train normally. But it was also bad for my recovery, because it sort of prevents the development of muscle. It actually creates like a catabolic state for your musculature. I apparently, according to a trainer that I had worked with shortly thereafter, that that medication in general was, it was bad for your, like memory and things like that, which of course in wrestling, you need to have, you need to be on point. You need to have your memory.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things, to remember, a lot of things to recall. And there was a lot of freedoms in New Japan's. But if that had happened where I was taking something that would cause me to blank out during a match when you're on live television and, or you have to hit it like a hard time, or if your time is cut instantaneously in a match and you couldn't come up with a plan B or couldn't get to where you needed to get to, that would have been dead in the water. So there were things that were able to get me through it, but I'm glad I just have never gotten to that state where, you know, we can get you some sleep at night. We can get you through your workouts in the day, but there may be repercussions during your matches, which I never, ever want to go to that place again. That was scary.
One thing, and I didn't know this about you. Mm-hmm. I knew about some of your other, you know, many of your other injuries, but the one I didn't know until pretty much you were finishing was the vertigo. And the idea that you had to compensate in the ring for vertigo for a time. I'm not sure how long, mm-hmm. but when you were talking about that, I mean, that sounded so, you know, compensating for dizziness sounds so difficult. But again, like from a fan standpoint, you know, I mean, from someone who watches your matches probably as close as almost anyone, I never noticed it. I mean, I never noticed anything where you looked dizzy or you looked off or you were missing something because your equilibrium was off. I mean, I never noticed that. So, I mean, how, you know, and you had mentioned something like you almost had to retrain your body to compensate for all that.
Yeah, this will sound silly, but I'm just trying to speak as honestly and as candidly as possible. But when it had happened, and I remember when it had happened, I had the one of the block finals against Okada, and one of the G1s, the one that I ended up going in the finals against Naito. And I had taken the Okada dropkick, and it was just a fluke thing. You know, Okada kind of does, like, you know, a real nice, high, pretty dropkick, as everyone knows. And he had landed on the side of my head with his knee off the dropkick. So it's almost like he did like the drop kick and like kind of like the sort of moonsault like out of it. And I bumped, you know, I guess just under him. And then the knee came down and I kind of knew when that happened. I was like, whoa, like I got caught in something. I wasn't sure what. And I finished the match and it was totally fine. And I loved the match. It was one of my favorite matches. And I would always say, you know, for people that want to kind of get introduced to what Okada and I had done, the easiest match for maybe a non-pro wrestling fan would have been that G1, because it was just
the 25-minute one.
It was no nonsense. It was the easiest match to digest in like a short period of time. You know, it wasn't going to be a huge time commitment. And there's that sort of state of urgency where it's like, okay, we know both these guys are looking to win this match as quick as possible. So I loved it, and I'm proud of it to this day. And as you know, Dave, you know, when you're the Block B final, you have to come back for the actual final less than 12 hours the next day.
Yeah, because you're
doing it all over again.
Because in those days, you're doing Saturday night and then Sunday afternoon. You know, it's not even Sunday night. Yeah.
Nope. Yeah, it was just crazy. So I remember going – you know, just being like worn out, tired, at Ryogoku, and then going home, getting a little bit of sleep. And I woke up and I'm like, okay, I guess it's time to go. And I would set my alarm a little later than normal, cause I just wanted as much rest as possible. And I went to go get up, and I did sort of like the sideways, you're trying to recapture your balance, but you're falling over sideways. And I hit my dresser and like a bunch of stuff fell off. I almost like tipped over a mirror, and I was like, what is going on? And I went back into bed and I laid down, and when I laid down flat, it was just really, really spinny. I moved to my side and I thought, okay, this spinningness is kind of dissipating a little bit. I'm feeling a little better if I stick to a side. And I thought, okay, maybe I can sleep this way. So I'll sleep a little bit more and see what's going on. And I'm just praying that it's going to get better. So I got a little bit more rest, like 20 minutes or so. I woke up and I was able to walk in a straight line. And I thought, like, what is it that I can do about this? And at first, because we just had the match, it's like, just get through it. And as I get through it, but as best as I can, try to get away from laying flat on my back for long periods of time, because that seemed to really sort of trigger that effect of like prolonged dizziness. So if I bump, you know, take the bump, boom, but get to a side quick, because that way I can sort of reset my equilibrium. And that was sort of my trick early on to figuring out a way to do it. And then I felt like in times when I can't do that, or if it gets out of hand, what am I going to do if it gets that bad, regardless of what I do? And I thought, okay, I'll just throw my hands up in the air and just say, just call it quits, call it a day. And the one thing I sort of found a little bit of inspiration in, and this is really silly, but again, I'm just going to recount it as I remember it. I had remembered that on some sort of variety television program in Japan, back when Pride was in its heyday, they would do the, you know, you put your head in a baseball bat and spin around a bunch of times. And the fighters would have to run in a straight line. It was just for fun. You have to run in a straight line and like high kick a dummy. And you get champion kickboxers, guys that are great at stand-up, guys, just the best fighters, the Terminators. However, the one person who did it as though the spinning didn't affect them at all was Sakuraba. He was able to spin around that bat at light speed and throw a kick as though it wasn't affecting him at all. And I thought, there's got to be a way that I can learn something, some sort of skill, teach myself something to work around this when it gets bad. And as long as I sort of had that inspiration, that there's maybe a way at a high level that I can not be affected by this or learn something to combat this, then I'll be able to figure it out. And the best thing that I was able to find, aside from sort of ways to not be as dizzy, was just a good chiropractor to make sure that my C1 was always in place. And if my C1 was in place, I would have, you know, days of relief when it wasn't bad at all. But in the times where it was bad, you know, there was sort of like a mental training and a physical aspect to the training as well, where I would know my body and know what positions I could be in that would allow for this condition to not be as bad or debilitating in the ring.
Now, looking back, since we're kind of looking forward and everything like this, I mean, when you look back at 2021, I mean, you know, you had a lot of obligations. You ended up, the Mexico thing didn't happen, even though you were the champion there, because of your injuries and because of COVID and it just, whatever. Yeah. But you were, you know, on you know, in the championship role there. You were in the championship role in Impact for months. And, you know, AEW, obviously, there every week with Don Callis and everything like that. And then, do you, now, I mean, I know that you had the, you know, you were, do you miss being there every week with Don and the Young Bucks and just with the whole crew for that matter?
Yeah, you know, I always, anytime I'm able to do anything creative with Don is really fun. He's great to have a conversation with about wrestling and wrestling related issues, because we are sort of the same thought process on a lot of things, where we look at what's happening on the show from a different angle and perspective. So as long as we're working together on a story or an angle, we're able to kind of step back, look at what's going to happen on the show, look what's scheduled to happen on the shows, and create something that's very visually different from everything else. Regardless if we were the focus on a show or not, or if there were plans to more heavily focus other people, or in a lot of cases, we get into a habit, I find, of having a lot of sort of gimmicky matches almost every week on the show. And it's like, how do we stand out in our segment when there's going to be this very bloody hardcore match? Or how are we going to stand out when, you know, the week after that, these guys are scheduled for a 30-minute in-ring and we're given 60 seconds? How do we maximize that? And it's easy to kind of just say, well, I guess we just weren't meant to be the focus. So forget it. Screw it. We'll just do a, we'll just do whatever. Finish it. Figure it out as we go along. We would always kind of put our heads together and figure out how do we maximize this time and how do we make it different, but different in a way where when people recall the episode or recall the show, go like, oh yeah, I remember this happened. And it actually kind of stands out as a talking point. And I think that was generally, you know, with the return of Punk and Brian coming in and just all these exciting things happening all the time, constantly at AEW. It's like, how do we shift the focus back to the story I have with Hangman? And we were lucky that we had these years and years and years of groundwork that we had laid. And that's always sort of been our storytelling style within the Elite, is to not ignore the things that have happened in the past and actually always, you know, as any human would, have a memory of it and allow that to shape our stories moving forward. So, having that history was great, and just being different and, calling back to more of, you know, the human emotion, sort of helps.
When you, I mean, as far as like the year went, I mean, mm-hmm. are you kind of, when you look back, I mean, Wrestler of the Year, you know, MVP, all that, mm-hmm. you know, the feud of the year, you know, several matches, very high. I mean, what was your, like, when you look back at, you know, what were your favorite matches of the year from this past year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a very good, very good question. I could say, you know, we just talked about the Hangman match, and for me, that was a huge relief to have done that without incident. And I guess the part that was the most fulfilling and rewarding from that match was like, geez, like, you guys saw everything under the sun, including some of the most anticipated moments in wrestling for the past, you know, decade, you know, CM Punk's return, but still, you know, the fans were very receptive and they wanted Hangman to win. They wanted that moment for him. And for me to do that and to create that atmosphere, and to do it without, any of us getting injured, and this, for me, knowing that Hangman was going to have to go into something pretty, physically demanding against Brian soon thereafter. That was a proud moment for me. The Arthur Ashe show was an incredible memory for me as well. It was, I don't want to call it righting the wrong. It wasn't that at all. And I still stand by my sort of thought process way back in the day when I did a straight up comedy match with Brian, just for something different. But I had thought our serious match together would have come much sooner after that PWG match. So it's sort of like, oh wow, finally we get to do, you know, this match that people had sort of expected out of us. But now, especially me, I'm far more qualified to give that to people. So it was cool for Brian to trust me with his comeback match in AEW. It was cool for Tony to trust us with that platform, at our largest weekly show by far. It was probably just our largest show in general, right? In terms of attendance. I don't think we've ever done that.
It's the record attendance for the company. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So to be trusted with that responsibility, when, you know, you had Brian coming back and it was sort of like, yeah, take my word for it. I'm ready to go. And, you know, then it's me. It's like, okay, I take my word for it. I'm the guy to do it. there was a lot of trust going into that match, and I'm glad we delivered. And what was cooler than, you know, feeling like we had done our company and our boss proud was that the fans were just enjoying it as much as we were in the ring. So that was a great memory. And I really enjoyed working Sammy at Impact. That was fun. And the first episode of Rampage where I was able to wrestle Christian. That was, in a lot of ways, very similar to the Bryan Danielson experience, where you had a lot of people leading up to that match. Like, where does this match come from? You know, why isn't Kenny wrestling Hangman? Oh, they really bait and switched us here. I can't believe it. This is a waste of time. But then we performed the match, and when we were there in that moment, the fans were really enjoying all the interactions between us. And I think they're really captivated just by the moments in the match. And I was happy to show, you know, what probably a lot of people already knew, was that Christian is actually really incredible in the ring. And he's such an intelligent performer. And I was glad to wrestle that style of match, which is one of my favorite styles to perform in, which is to value every movement, whether it be the placement of a move, of a spot, of a punch, of a kick, of a body slam. Everything just had a very high value and return towards it. And I feel that you can't, a lot of times you don't get, you're allowed for that when you wrestle a younger talent, because younger talents are sort of expected to go like, go, 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 go. And they like to chain their moves together. And it's hard to elicit that kind of reaction. But with someone like Christian, who's had such a history of being, you know, in this place and that place, being a champion and valuing his own moveset over the years, where, you know, a frog splash is a huge move, his spear is a huge move. And of course the Unprettier is a huge move. It's really cool to get into a situation where just one move is enough, and you can build a story in those moments in between time, rather than wasting a lot of energy and valuable time on TV to do other moves to elicit that, to try to get to that same reaction. And Bryan has that too about him, where he is able to get a lot of mileage out of very few moves. And in the same regard as well, going back to, you know, it's already old news now, but all the Okada stuff, you know, Okada gets a lot of mileage out of his stuff. So yeah. I feel that I strive in those situations where I can take that extra time to help build the real story and connection with the fans through the in-between stuff, rather than just the moves themselves.
Can we go back to the Omega and Danielson match just for a second? Because I think what came out of that was this idea for a very passionate wrestling fan base to say, oh, the idea of dream matches on a big stage are kind of back. And there are other guys who I'm sure, you are looking forward to wrestling, who you maybe haven't ever wrestled or only had a few matches or haven't had like that big stage match. Is there one or two who are kind of on that list? I imagine there's a bunch, but I was just kind of wondering if there's like, you know, one or two who you're like circling, like, at some point getting there is going to be awesome.
Yeah, no, I feel like there is an opportunity to tell a really interesting story with Adam Cole at some point. I don't know when, and you just got to feel it out. I don't like ever being bound to something by a certain time. Like I love being able to feel the atmosphere, to listen to the fans' response, to really gauge when the proper time is to pull the trigger. So when the timing is right, or as right as it can be, hopefully I'm able to investigate that storyline. I've always had a real good relationship with Jay White over the years. Known him since he was the guy doing my laundry in New Japan, and always supported his venture and his journey in professional wrestling, and extremely proud for him to take sort of the opportunity that was before him and make it his own. I really feel that he was sort of unfairly compared to me and or others when he was given this incredible responsibility of being a top guy, when maybe it was really soon, too soon. And he was able to transform his look, his character, his wrestling style to really be something unique and something that fit him. So I would love to have that rematch with Jay, with the current version of the new Jay, and hopefully be an instrument for him to really show how far he's come, which, you know, I think an American audience really hasn't seen that yet. And it's tough to really see that. I mean, I think the best version of Jay White that we got was probably Tokyo Dome against Ibushi, where
it sort of embodied
that New Japan big time main event, epic main event style, but it had a lot of the sort of influences from North American babyface heel wrestling culture. And he was able to sort of blend those in seamlessly without looking out of place in a strong style main event matchup. So in that sense, when you really look, take a step back and look at it, you know, this is a guy that hasn't had to rely on raw athletics, high flying maneuvers, things that'll blow your mind. From a spectacle standpoint, it's just someone who is placing things in the right way and being there for his opponent, to create this epic feeling to a matchup. And, I think, you know, in AEW with Tony being as generous as he is with being able to showcase talent, I think that even if it's not me, I hope that Jay gets a chance to show something to the American fan base, because he's really developed into one of the great talents in professional wrestling.
Now, before I actually, one question I have is, when you're preparing for the match mentally for Danielson, mm-hmm. or a match with Okada or a match with Hangman, you know, where you know it's a big stage match, you know people are expecting something really big, you kind of have to look, you know one of the curses of having the matches that you've had is that sometimes good or even very good isn't good enough. Because I remember, and I just remember this one, like when you did the second match with Okada, when the match mm-hmm. started in like the first few minutes, I was thinking, I mean, I never thought of it about like this until the match is on. And all of a sudden when the match is on, it's like, oh my God, like you have to have a match as good as the first one. And to me, I thought that, what kind of pressure is that? And maybe it wasn't even any pressure at all for you two, but I thought, like, because again,
it was.
Like,
it was.
Yeah. Because it's one thing if you're in a regular match and people are expecting, you just go out there and have a really great match, that's fine. But when you're in a situation where like the match with Danielson, it's almost like you guys are so good that people are sitting there almost, you know, like, they disappointed me, you know, they're waiting for you disappointed me. And you, one of the things that I enjoyed about the match so much was when it was over, it was just like, no one's going to say that. No one can say that. And I'm sure somebody did somewhere, but you know what I'm saying? It's like even,
absolutely,
even people who, you know, don't want to praise it, you know, you kind of have to go, okay, you know, I don't want to say outdid themselves, but they lived up to Kenny Omega versus Bryan Danielson on a big stage in a big time match. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking back as to before this, you know, the whole opportunity for me to do what I had always wanted to do in wrestling had started. It was probably in the midst of the G1, well, tail end of my first G1 in 2016, where I'd first learned that, I guess I'm going to be able to have this, you know, pretty high stakes match against Naito in the block final. And, I had thought, because Naito was really on the fast track to being the top star of the company before I had heard that, you know, was going to be me going to the finals, that at the very least, you know, I've tried to really dress up this first G1 performance of mine as something special and something where I would give a pretty good performance regardless of where we were. I wanted to make that match feel like a final. And it was, to this day, one of my favorite performances, actually. That match still means a lot to me. To go from that to then winning the G1, and then sort of, for me, things never really slowed down. when that first Okada match hit, and I had realized afterward just how many people stateside, you know, all over the world, you know, whether it be people outside of Japan, had actually watched this match, or due to, you know, perhaps efforts from you guys and others, just kind of word of mouth saying like, hey, you should check this match out. People were watching this match and they were falling in love with the New Japan style. So it was really difficult for me to be presented with this idea that we're going to do this match again. And they're expecting that Tokyo Dome level of performance. And what is it that you do? And I had sort of thought like, man, how does Tana and Okada do this all the time? Because they had, at that point, they'd already had, you know, probably at least four or five. And they never disappointed anyone either. So how is it that I can do this without letting people down? And I remember going to Gato and saying like, hey, I'm really worried about this one. no offense. And he's like, no, don't. He said, don't even worry about it. He says, it's all good. He says, don't worry about matching the Tokyo Dome. Just go out there. We can even make this match like 15 minutes. Just 15 minutes, you lose. It's all good. It's like, don't worry about it. It's fine. People just want to see Okada win. And, you know, because Okada loves, it was always a great visual for our domestic fans at that point, for Okada to close the show. They loved it. Or, you know, Okada and Tana closing a show was always like the happy ending that they wanted to see. And I remember exactly where I was on the sofa in the dojo, and I was sitting there with Okada, and, you know, we looked at each other, and when we met eyes kind of on the couch, the story isn't going where you think it's going. we're like, man, we can't just do a 15 minute match at Osaka Joe Hall. Like, just, we can't do that. So I had thought like, man, I was in a very good place athletically and condition wise. And Okada, of course, just young, generally injury free. He can go for days. I thought like, man, what if we go the limit? Like, what if we do an actual like Broadway? And, you know, the big concern, the huge concern, which was met with a lot of deliberation, was like, oh my God, but who's going to close the show then? You know, who's going to give like the victory speech at the end of the show? And I was like, no, Okada can still do it. Like, he's going to be the champ, but like, let's really do something like unique, crazy, something that people haven't seen in a long time. And, I would say probably from that point on, it was a very collaborative effort with Gato and myself. Like, okay, what do we do now? Like, what kind of crazy idea do you have this time, Kenny? And that was the start of a very fun time where I could really step outside the box. And you know, that's when I had nothing but trust from Gato and the company when I said like, hey, what about a best 2 out of 3 for the next one? There's always that feeling of like, if you go bigger, is it necessarily going to be better? And, you know, I've mostly seen the positive benefits from going bigger and trying to be better. And there are times when it blows up in my face or literally does not blow up in my face, where I tried to go bigger and better with Moxley, had a match that I was very proud of looking back at, aside from that last explosion in the explosive exploding barbed wire death match. And there's both sides of the coin, right? You take those chances. But sometimes it's not always going to work out. And sometimes it's going to be something that's not even in your control. There's nothing we could have done to make that better. It just happened the way that it happened. And unfortunately, that's sort of the memory that sits with people. Had we not tried to do something different, there probably wouldn't have even been that interest for that match anyway, or at least not as much. So for me, even if there are nerves, or if there's a little bit of, you know, if there are worries behind it, I know that if I don't push the envelope, if I don't push my own boundaries, if I don't try as hard as I can to give the fans something new or something that I know that deep down inside I'm capable of, I feel that it's a slight to the fans. And when I know that I have a capable opponent that's standing across the ring from me, that sort of reinforces that I shouldn't worry about how things are going to end up. And that's why I never worried with Okada. That's why I never worried with Moxley. And you know, I knew Brian enough, even just from the PWG experience, that there is a trust there where we're going to be okay regardless of what happens. So as much as me kind of not being a coward helps my performances, having complete 100% faith in my opponent is one of the main ingredients to me feeling like I can push my limits.
Going in a different subject, and this is probably the big thing that everyone's been talking about since, I guess, Monday afternoon.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, baby.
Stone Cold Steve Austin's back. That's right. Can you imagine that day? For Garrett, I mean, like, can you imagine it's Valentine's Day, right? And it's Valentine's Day, and I wake up, and it's something's going on with Cody, and Stone Cold Steve Austin's coming back. And it's like, oh boy, you know, and no one knows it yet, but knowing that it's wrestling in 12 hours, they probably will. Right. And so I'm out and I'm getting texts when I promised I'm not going to be working. But anyway, but what was, you know, again, like, I mean, what was your reaction to the Cody thing? I mean, did it blindside
you? Everyone was shocked. Yeah. I mean, wrestling is we all know when our deals are up, like, especially the EVPs. Like, we know when our deals are up. We know when our, in the case of the Bucks, like, when their options kick in. For myself, I don't have a deal like that. As you know, I'm up next year, just straight up done. So I'd have to re-sign a new one. There's no option. And, you know, we knew Cody's, much like the Bucks, it was that time. And when, you know, we would hear that, okay, there's possibly some difficulty with the renegotiation or whatever. It was almost like you never think it's going to go in that direction where the talent is going to opt for leaving. Especially since, you know, when this first thing started, I would say the most passionate person about a revolution, the most passionate person about kind of creating an us versus them mentality was Cody. So it was strange for him just to choose to up and walk away. However, that being said, you know, feelings change. The environment around you is ever changing. It's constantly changing. And maybe, you know, the mission statement or the goal or the revolution, whatever it is that you're searching for, trying to create, maybe that isn't what it is anymore to you. Maybe that, you know, isn't your inspiration. Isn't what gets you out of bed every day. So I would always encourage everyone, you know, in wrestling, in life, whatever, if your work isn't fulfilling, if it doesn't make you happy, you really should look for opportunities elsewhere, in a place where you can feel creatively free, in a place where you feel that your work is being appreciated and fulfilled. I know, I can't say I know. I'm guessing that knowing Cody as well as I know him, I don't think it was an issue of money. I don't think it was Tony not shelling out enough cash to keep him invested with the company. Cody, he really believed in the vision, in the original vision that he brought to the table for AEW. And I think the original vision that the team brought to the table when AEW was first becoming a promotion, we didn't know where this would go. We had been optimistic about it. We had thought we would be where we are today, where we would be considered, you know, a major promotion, and we would have our fan base, and we would have hopefully a lot of satisfied customers watching our product. But I guess we never really sat down and talked to each other about, okay, we have this opportunity to now change wrestling. How do you see it? How do we make this work? And maybe in the end, you know, we had the Bucks and their vision. We had my vision, and then we had Cody's vision. And all of our visions were different from one another. And I would say mine was more similar to what the Bucks had envisioned, and Cody's was out there. It was much different. You're going to get that, I think, when finally you've committed your life to an industry and a business, and finally someone goes, okay, you've done this job all your life. You've been raised into this business with these shackles on you to a degree by someone or something. Now those are off. You've got carte blanche. What is it you want to do? And I can understand that there might be some heartbreak if you were promised that or told that and it doesn't come to fruition. I get it. I mean, but again, though my professional relationship with Cody was great. He's not a guy that I go and get a Diet Pepsi with in my off time. So I don't know how he personally feels about anything. I can only guess as to why he would leave. And I just think that he saw it with his deal up as an opportunity to investigate something within wrestling or in just life in general that would bring him more happiness. And again, like I don't want anyone doing what we do in wrestling and being completely unhappy or miserable, because that destroys you. It's a such a huge like mental, emotional, and physical commitment that if you're miserable while doing it, it can only lead to bad things. And you know, we've seen it in wrestling where that can lead to terrible things, whether it be, you know, alcohol, pills, drugs,
depression.
Day. And exactly. And that runs rampant in wrestling. Yeah. And I would hate for that to happen when what we were set out to do was something extremely positive for professional wrestling, or that was always the goal anyway. And that's sort of where the Bucks and I differed, where we never wanted to go to war with Vince or WWE. We just wanted to give people an option and just get us a platform for our brand of storytelling and our style of wrestling. And I think, you know, when Cody had his way of going about things, I wasn't sure how to follow up with that, nor was I interested. And so there was sort of like, there's Kenny doing his thing. There's the Bucks doing their thing. And there's the Codyverse over there doing whatever it is that he does. And then there's the stuff that Tony does. And then eventually, you know, as you know, I guess probably a lot of fans know now, you know, it's essentially now just it's Tony's show. And you know, of course he's always going to listen to our advice and he's going to, take our suggestions to heart, but AEW is very much, you know, Tony's thing, Tony's baby. And, we're there to support it in any way that we can. And, it's very possible that this current version of AEW just wasn't a good fit for Cody, to Cody. For me, you know, I feel like he was one of the original four. There's always going to be a place for him. And there's always, you saw it in his ladder match with Sammy. He's got incredible utility and he's able to help our younger talent. So it's not nothing from an in-ring perspective. There's no issues there. If I had a clear-cut answer for you guys, I would love to tell you. But I don't know it, and all I can say is that whatever he decides to do, I heard he's on a flight to Saudi Arabia. If that makes him happy, that makes him happy. I just again, Bucks and I we weren't in this for the war, so. All the guys and gals at WWE doing their thing, always wishing for the best for those guys. Always.
The one thing, okay, like you weren't in it for the war, but I know from, you know, I guess talking to, you know, in contact with Matt, especially at that point in time, is that, yep. and even more Jericho, is mm-hmm. The acknowledgement that whether you want the war or not, you're in a war because that's the way Vince operates, in the sense
the nature
that,
of the business. Yeah,
the
yeah,
nature of the
absolutely.
Business. I mean, the first, you know, day one. I mean, look, before the TV deal was even announced. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I knew, and it wasn't that somebody from WWE told me. I followed Vince for, 40 years. I'm not saying I know everything how he thinks, but I most of the time I'm pretty good at how he thinks.
You said it was the playbook at the time, right? Like that's the way you kind of talked about it.
I mean, I don't know if I told you, but I certainly told them that, NXT is going to go head to head. I mean, that's what he's going to do. And, I thought we all thought it would be on FS1. We didn't think it would be on USA, which was actually a stronger platform. I thought FS1, I thought, at FS1, I thought, TNT versus FS1, it might even not even be the right fight for Vince to pick. But then he goes on USA and it's like, okay, this is going to be, he got a bigger cable platform. So it's going to be a big fight. And then it was, and then what happened. But, the one thing that again, from a Cody standpoint is, is like, and like you're one of the few people who would understand this one is like, you are in a position, you're not running the show, but you are certainly a valuable part of the show. And the person who is running the show, will listen to you and, will trust you in the sense of he's not micromanaging every move you do. He's not telling you word for word what to do on your promo. You have it's like you go out there and come up with something to entertain the fans. This is your time. Mm-hmm. Here's what you do. This is your direction. Now you come up with how you're going to fill up that story, but you know where you're going. Okay. So you have that, and to go, and for Cody, who clearly wants to be creative, okay, I mean, that's one thing you can tell, whatever he wants to be creative, to go and have that freedom, to a degree, because no one has complete freedom, but a lot of freedom, a lot of power in a sense, and to go to a place where you are going to be, you're going to be micromanaged again. It was something that I like nothing surprises me, to that degree.
Right.
You know what I mean? Especially the contract was up. I mean, look, the contract's up and it's like, you know what I mean? It's like at the level Cody's at, there's two choices. He's not going to Ring of Honor that barely exists. He's not going to Impact for full time. He's not. And at this point, he's not going to New Japan either. I mean, that 4 years ago, New Japan was different and the travel was easier and all that, right? But he's not doing
it. It was much different than Rush than 3 or 4 years ago, yes.
Yeah, it was on fire and great. And not that it's not good, not that it's not great now, but COVID did a number on it.
I feel like it was affected. New Japan and Ring of Honor really got hit hard by COVID, I would say.
Yeah, they were both hurt bad. Impact to a degree, but I think that they survived it better. But New Japan,
yeah, they did a real good job with it.
Yeah, I mean, New Japan, I mean, it's like, one of the things that I think we all learned from COVID, more than anything, is how important the fans are. Because I remember Tanahashi, Tanahashi actually did an interview, and he was in tears when they first got the fans back, saying like how important, he never knew how important it was. Because, here we're watching matches and you watch a match so differently without crowd response, and it's much harder to have a good match or to be entertained without that crowd. And I've heard from other people that it probably hurts a lot more when you're doing this stuff.
It does. I can speak to that candidly. I mean, at this time last year, when we were wrestling outdoors in Jacksonville, when it was 30 degrees and we had a front row of extras pretending to be people in the crowd, everything hurt. You couldn't warm up. You couldn't feel that adrenaline. It was tough. And, one thing that you can never take away from the performance in New Japan is they have an absolute genuine passion for performing and being wrestlers. They love getting in a ring. It means everything in the world to them to perform in a wrestling ring. And so I think when you take away that ability for fans to fully enjoy themselves, for them to come with all of their best friends and family, sit side by side to be able to cheer and jeer and, have the time of their lives to then, do the social distancing thing, to have to wear masks, to only be able to clap. It sucks the life out of that experience a little bit. And I can definitely empathize and sympathize with Tana on that behalf. Because the New Japan fans were always so generous and so kind, and their reactions, when you could elicit those huge reactions from them, you knew that they weren't, it wasn't like a canned reaction where it's like, oh, I think I have to react now, so I'm going to. They were very genuinely pouring out their emotions for the wrestlers to see and feel and hear. And for them to not have that for such a period of time when they were still expected to give that high standard of very hard hitting New Japan style of match, that must have been real rough on everyone involved.
So anyway, with Cody and everything, it's like, I just wonder, and again, nothing against WWE. It's just, but it is different. You know, it's,
oh, of course.
You know, it's like he's not going to have that's the big thing when the people come, no matter who it is, everyone who comes over, the first thing they talk about is the freedom to express themselves that in WWE, yeah. you don't have to clear something through seven people. You just do it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know, you don't have word for word handed to you in script. You say what you think. And, you know, to me, one of the things with AEW to me that has been, you know, because you never, you know, you always say like, well, you know, WWE has been so successful at what they do. But sometimes I'll be like, you know, the wrestling that I watched in the 80s was better. You know, I mean, at least the talking was better. I'll just say that the talking was better. And it was.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. You know, when you watch those 80s or 90s interviews, you know, or 80s interviews in particular. But, you know, 90s too, but before it became so scripted and everything. But you go like, but the world is different, my God, and the world's changing so fast. And I mean, it is. I mean, I just did a class this morning and, you know, and to realize how, you know, and you did one too. Remember, well, you did one with the
I did.
In Japan. Yep. In Japan.
We talked the importance of entertainment during the COVID era.
Which is
a lot of fun. And I remember telling you, like, geez, I got this thing coming up. Could you help me out? I've never done one before. And you told me that I'd really enjoy it. And I did. I loved it. I would love to do it again at some point.
Yeah, I did one this morning and I loved it. But the thing that was so noticeable to me is from how much the world is changing in the sense of how people consume things is changing. And, you know, we had the president of the Oakland A's was there and, you know, some really, really bright students and people who are working at major companies, cable companies and things like this. And to see how that television landscape is changing. And the point is, what was so interesting to me is that we're in there with these experts and like, nobody really like we're everyone's flying blind. It's not like somebody goes, okay, this is where we're going to be in 5 years. We're just going to have to get there. It's like, no, we don't know because there's so many variables in the sense of we know younger people are watching television in a different way and watching a lot of streaming and we want to reach them at the same time. There's no money to be made there yet, although at some point there will be. But the money's in television, and there's still, you know, more people will watch television still. But will they? If you're making a, like, let's say a 10-year deal in your Major League Baseball, just an example. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're flying blind. I mean, one thing like Garrett, the RSNs, you know, the regional sports networks and everything, which Sinclair bought, and it's turning into a complete disaster. And Major League Baseball almost bought them. And, you know, they are so happy that they got outbid because it's like, oh, my God, we've been holding the bag for this thing that, you know, it seemed like a good business at the time, but everything is changing and it's not a good business anymore. But that's off topic. But, you know, the thing is like when it comes to the future of television streaming consumption and everything like this, you know, whether it's Vince McMahon or Nick Khan or Tony Khan or whatever, it's like, the president, the head of Major League Baseball or the head of the NBA, it's like, we all know that everything is changing really fast. but we don't know where it's going. And that is a really, it's absolutely a fascinating period right now that we're good. And a wrestling franchise, like, you know, like any other sports franchise, it's like, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, like Tony, you know, obviously today brought up that he's working on a deal, and I don't know what it is, but it's like, that's the thing. It's like, you know, the big things that's going to go as it goes forward is these deals. What are they going to be? Who are they going to be with? That's going to be, you know, that's like they're going to be the lifeblood of the future of this business, in the sense of, you know, you're going to wrestle and all that, but you know, where, you know, what kind of platforms, what kind of hours do you, you know, do you want to overexpose yourself with too much, but at the same time, you get paid more for more content? There's so many interesting factors, you know, going in. And I mean, it's going to be, you know, that aspect's going to be very, very, that the business aspect of wrestling in the next 3 years, it's going to, I mean, there's aspects of it that are going to really change. But where they change to, I don't think we still know yet.
No one knows. You'd have to have some sort of level of clairvoyance to really be able to predict where things are headed. And I think that's why people are more so tentative to commit full-fledged into this, that, or the other, because we don't know. You know, it's just a human race as people. We sort of took everything for granted, you know, that things are going to be this way for quite some time, and it is what it is, and yada, yada, yada. And now being considered some form of sport, whether it's, you know, performance show or not, professional wrestling's in sort of a lucky spot where we can sort of fall in that bracket with other live sports, where we can be a featured attraction that people will tune in live for to watch. But like you said, it's like, what are people going to want to tune in live, or are they going to prefer, you know, the streaming route of things? How is it that you're going to create your fan base, keep them invested? How is it that you're going to make your money? How do you supplement all these big deals that, you know, both sides are doing, both us and AEW side of things and both WWE side of things? You know, what are our big moves, and how do we sort of safeguard those and stay afloat and maintain sort of a position of prominence? A lot of times it's just sort of kind of like pin the tail on the donkey, like close your eyes and make an educated guess as to what's best. But, you know, we could wake up tomorrow and next thing you know, someone puts a ban on all television. and you know what I mean? Like we you never know. We need to sort of expect the unexpected now in this world. And if you put all your eggs in one basket, it might cripple your company. So I think, you know, both us, AEW and WWE, I think we're trying to sort of, dip our toes in multiple ventures to make sure that there are ways to always be active and available for our fans to consume our product. So I think in that sense, you know, for the people that have to make those hard decisions, they're unsung heroes, because essentially they're kind of keeping the wrestling business alive. But for us as performers, all we can do is just counter blessings that there is a demand for these live events.
So the people who listen to this show know that I've mentioned it before, I've worked for pretty much small companies, startups, my entire career. Current one I'm at, I think, gosh, it'll be 14 years in April, but we started from scratch, essentially. And when you know, comparing to what you guys did with AEW, you know, there is now sort of a chapter has ended with the, you know, one of the day one folks.
I remember when you went through Founders leaving.
It was very emotional, and you know, there's lots of different emotions going through that. But I guess my question is, because of the situation happened, one of your founders, one of your day one folks left. It's kind of like ends that chapter, now new chapter. But is there a very early moment when it was all of you in the very beginning trying to get this thing going? Everyone's probably working, nutty amounts of hours. You know, you're trying, yeah. You're trying to build all of these different things. People have different ideas on what they want to do. And there's moments of like where everyone's in complete harmony. And there's moments in which everything's sort of chaotic and you're like, wow, are we going to actually be able to do this? But is there a moment from those early, early mm-hmm. days that you think that you will sort of reflect on, from time to time as like, man, you know, that was really fun. And I miss those days of when it was like craziness, and I'm sure it's crazy in a different way today, but I'm just going back to those like early days. Is there going to be a moment for you?
Absolutely. No, I really do think so. I think that the point of time, and I'm not sure if you guys can recall, but aside from the show itself, the story surrounding that show, both going into it and coming out of it, I would say the original Fyter Fest in AEW was that time for me where we were still trying to compile just enough core members to our team to even run a show. And to be able to have this show materialize and teaming up with CEO, you know, the video game competition, fighting game competition run by Alex Jabaley, and just to kind of give, and the decision by Tony to say like, yeah, let's release this thing for free. Let's get some awareness out there. And then to kind of give people the type of show that at the time we thought was going to be very representative of our company moving forward, which is just, this is a very organic, fun show. At that point we didn't really have, like cohesive storylines. So it was easy just to kind of really book it like how a PWG show would be booked. I was like, okay, let's take these two guys that probably have good chemistry and toss them out there and just have them do their thing. And I loved that time with the company. And I loved, just seeing, you know, the joy from the fans and hearing the positive feedback from people saying like, hey, we came to the show kind of not knowing what AEW was, what those letters even stood for, but boy, like, was this a fun time. And like, whatever you guys do from here on in, like, we can't wait to see more. And, you know, we had, the best of some of the Western talent, and we had, you know, foreign talent. We had people from, we had, Luchador, Lucha Libre, wrestling, represented. We had, Strong Hearts represented. We had, hardcore wrestling style represented with, the Mox and Joey Janela match. We did, I think that was, if I'm not mistaken, I think that was our first draw with the company with Darby and Cody. There's just a lot. And even though there was a lot, it never felt forced in. And I to me, it just felt like just a real organic, fun wrestling show. And, I remember, even though there were stressful moments with, you know, like insurance with the building and permits and, you know, parts of our set not arriving and all that, it was the perfect storm of headaches, but things that worked out better than we could have expected. And that sort of was like, to me, that is the best early memory of the company for me was everything surrounding that show, both coming in and going out.
10 years from now. Okay. Obviously, I don't want to say, you know, who knows? I mean, because people 48 years old are still wrestling and some wrestling extremely well. And, you know, Christian's that age and mm-hmm. he had, you know, and he can go.
Absolutely.
But we go, I mean, when your days, you know, and you know, you're in a position where if you go away and come back, I mean, the nostalgia thing is very big in some ways. You know, I mean, it's a funny story is that you'll probably be loved and revered in some ways more 10 years from now than now.
That'd be because, nice.
No, because if you think, because I look at a guy like Sting, just as an example, who,
oh,
you know,
wow,
it's like, you know, the reaction to him. I mean, it's different. I mean, he was a big star always, but, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot more, you know, as long as you don't get into, you know, legal trouble or something like that. But I mean, as far as, you know, that nostalgia thing kicks in and everything like that, and people are just happy to see you, you know, your childhood or from 10 years ago or whatever. But anyway, but when you are no longer going to be a full-time pro wrestler, is your mentality to stay in the business as far as in the front office and, you know, learn, you know, or continue to do business and help younger talent and lay out matches and, you know, things like that? Or do you just want to, when wrestling is over, you know, move on to another, you know, another form of thing that'll be, that'll float your boat, so to speak? I mean, or do you even think about it? You're even thinking about that at this stage?
No, I'm always thinking about it, especially now, because I mean, you see how fragile everything is and how it could end. And I don't necessarily mean that even from a personal standpoint. Like, I could be injured and it's over, or some women's procedures could go wrong and they kind of have to give you the bad news that, you know, this, you know, you'll never be the same and you can't be the person that you want to be in the ring. Or, you know, oppositely, it could be a thing where, you know, it's like I said, where we wake up tomorrow and all of our, everything digital has been hacked by some sort of alien life form and there's no way for, you know, material to get out there. It could happen. Who knows? Right. Yeah. So if it all ended from that world out of our control, just, sorry guys, AEW isn't a thing. All wrestling isn't a thing. What is it that I do? And I get a lot out of being an agent. I really enjoy that. I don't think I could ever have a dojo or have a school. And a big part of the reason is just, I'm just too lazy to organize something like that. But for me to be in a position where I could teach or give advice or lay out matches, I find that very personally fulfilling. So if there were ever an opportunity like that in wrestling, once I'm done actively, I feel like I would be happy in the workplace being able to do that. And I see, you know, incredible performers from when I was just watching on television, guys like Jerry Lynn and Dean Malenko. And, you know, I see sort of the joy that they get out of knocking one of their matches out of the park. And I can totally understand that feeling. I mean, when I would do, you know, a girls' match that, you know, had high stakes and they knock it out of the park, it's this incredible feeling. And it brought me back to when I would coach basketball. And I love being a coach. I love being in that position. So I do feel like, you know, even if I'm not a performer, there is something I can take from professional wrestling and really find it fulfilling. But I do have other interests as well. You know, I love working in the gaming community. I love working, with anime, TV, and all that sort of stuff. And, if there are opportunities there, you know, it'd be great to investigate those too, but wrestling will always probably at some point be a part of my life. Even if, you know, I'm just a guy who's doing a guest podcast appearance every now and then to give my perspective, I probably would never say no to that. Because I enjoy having an opinion and just talking about it. So yeah, I always see wrestling as something that's part of me. And if I have anything that I could give and, or give back, I would like to do it.
That's a very poetic way to end the show, but I'm going to ruin it for a second because you mentioned the video mm-hmm. game and WWE 2K22 is coming out soon. I think, Dave, you could be a GM like Shane McMahon if you want in this game. Is there any update that you could give us before we get out of here? I know people are always wondering, you know, about this game. There's lots of gamers out there mm-hmm. who desperately want that one wrestling game on the new system. So is there anything that any late mm-hmm. news on that?
Yeah, you know what? We're actually working on our next presentation. So this what we're working nonstop around the clock on this game. There are a lot of deadlines that we're really trying to reach. However, we don't ever want to keep anyone in the dark completely. And it's been quite some time since we've had an actual update. not just of information, but we want to be able to show people something. So I would expect, hopefully, to have something prepared for people to show very soon. I don't want to promise at the pay-per-view or in that pay-per-view week, but we were hoping to possibly show a little more of where we're at and a little bit more progression, you know, reveal possibly a new character or characters. It is coming along though. And for us, or at least, you know, for me, there's a large emphasis on just the wrestling aspect of the game. We want the wrestling to, and it's tough to get that balance, but we want it to feel like how a match would flow, but within a video game. So, you know, the matches will go, probably in general, go a little bit quicker. But we want them to feel like the user is able to assume the role of their favorite AEW superstar and or whoever it is that they create in our creator wrestler mode. And when they mix it up in the ring in whatever match type that they choose, that they're having a fun time and they feel like they're in control of their person and that the moves have impact. They feel everything. And that it's fun, but at the same time, if you want to be really competitive about it, you know, there's that there too. I hope there's, like I said, we'll never be able to compete with the production values of WWE's game. You look at 2K22, it's absolutely gorgeous. So I'm excited to see all their bells and whistles when it finally releases. But for us, rather than pushing the envelope graphically or anything like that, we just want the wrestling to feel like how it used to feel for the people who would play wrestling games back in the day and just have fun with fellow wrestling fans or, you know, people that just want to have fun with their buddies. And maybe they don't know who Luchasaurus is. Maybe they don't know who Chris Jericho is, but you know, they'll be able to pick a character on the screen and go like, oh, this guy's fun to play as. That's sort of the feeling that I want to, as sort of a creative designer, to bring back to video games. I remember being the only wrestling fan on my hockey team, but it was always part of our rotation. We would like play with the guys in the dressing room. It was, you know, we'd go to GoldenEye, then we'd put in WCW versus NWO, and everyone had their favorites, even though they didn't know who they were. They had no clue. But, you know, people would, there was a guy who would love Ultimo Dragon. There was a guy that would love Joe Boxer. There's a guy that would love Dim Sum, and a guy that, you know, these characters, which they were just made up characters based off of some of them based off of active wrestlers in Japan. People just assumed that Dim Sum was a character, an actual wrestler somewhere in WCW, but he wasn't. But we're all having fun in this, regardless, in the same way. So I hope that we can elicit those sort of feelings where you don't have to be like an AEW maniac or just a complete wrestling fan through and through to enjoy our game. That's the hope anyway.
Yeah. When I was right out of high school, I worked for Blockbuster Video and we would shut down the store, shut down at midnight. And then, you know, you got to clean it up and sort of prepare it for the next day. But then we would spend from like 12:30 or 1 AM until like 3 AM, like four of us would just stick around and we'd play the WCW game. just because it's so fun to play with, you know, with a bunch of different people. One more thing, actually, and I know we're out of time, but the future of these video games, it's kind of about the, you know, what they call the metaverse and the idea that, you know, your wrestling game exists as a wrestling game, but it also exists with all of these other millions of users who, you know, you could go to the Tokyo Dome or like just this idea that it's not just the in-ring anymore. It's not just the create a player mode or you know, the whatever the GM stuff that we hear from WWE. It's really exists way beyond that. And that's got to be really fun to think about for like future iterations of the game as well.
Oh, it is. It's all, for me, it's all about human interaction and whether that's be specifically online, or if it's offline with your buddies on a, you know, the couch, just hanging out for pizza or whatever that people do together. You know, I want that to be a fun experience in so many realms within this game. We've got a lot of match types, game modes. I think people are going. You know, obviously there's going to be cross-platform. There's going to be an online component where, of course, you'll be able to create your own lobbies and all that, and have a lot of fun with friends or people that you meet online. The ability to defend belts and all that sort of stuff. Just plenty of ways to interact with people in different ways, to be able to sort of build a community and interact with people, have fun in this wrestling universe. It's not just about the wrestling itself, but it's always about bringing people together as best as you can, which is sort of, you know, not the main focus, or shouldn't be the main focus, but it's one of my focuses. Is I would like to see that happen. I'd like to see this game be a chance for just wrestling fans or people that enjoy the game to have as many outlets as they can to bring themselves and their friends together to have a fun time, either offline or online.
All right. Dave, is there anything else before we get out of here?
No, I just want to thank Kenny for doing the show, and congratulations for all the awards. And really enjoyed this. I think we touched on a lot of topics. I don't think that we had planned on most of them going in. So I
like those the best, though. I like it when it's spontaneous like that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's made it for a great show. So I really enjoyed it very much. Yeah.
All right. So
yeah, and I mean, I'm sorry.
No. Go for it.
Oh, I was just gonna say, you know, it really does mean a lot for everyone at year end to have the ability to vote and give their opinions, and it means a lot that so many people that have so many options to watch professional wrestling, consume professional wrestling. And I find that, you know, people that subscribe to sort of these, you know, third party newsletters, they're wrestling fans through and through. They may have their preference, but they watch everything. So it's cool to be in a conversation with all of these top talents, whether it be from New Japan, ROH, WWE. I know it causes debate and it gets people angry, but for me, I'm just happy to sort of be in the conversation with a lot of these top names in our industry. And I'm sure most of them feel the same way too. So I think it's a wonderful thing that you've done.
Thanks. And congratulations on a great year under, when going through the year injured, but putting forth and, you know, solidifying the company. You know, I mean, I think the company overall had a great year. I mean, it had its best year to date, for sure. I mean, and grew in a lot of ways and solidified itself. I mean, you know, like one of the things with the thing is, when it starts, the very start is kind of almost easy because of the momentum, and then it becomes harder, I think, in a lot of ways to sustain.
Oh, it does.
You know what I mean? Because then, you know, there was something very early on, the novelty of something new. I mean, now you're in year three, and it's not, you know, it's not novelty. When you go into a city for the fourth time and you're drawing more than you did the previous times, I mean, that's a very positive thing that when you look at it, and you're doing this, you know, in place after place, you know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But to me, like, the generally more yes than no, I think that that is a really,
it's a good indicator that we're off to a good start. You know, we're doing the right thing.
You're entertaining the people, and it's a tough business to start from scratch. I mean, it may not be a tough business when you're 40 years in and you've got, like, you know, and all this, but what you guys did, I mean, look, you know, you succeeded at a level. I mean, there's many, many, many people who started stuff, you know, in the last 20 years and even before that, from scratch, like purely from scratch. I mean, like it's not like Turner bought WCW. Well, WCW is the same show that they'd had on TV for decades before that. So it's not from scratch. And as far as starts from scratch, I mean, you've been the most successful from scratch, you know, of our lifetime. And I mean, that's, you know, and it's a business and in something that many, many failures have been in, you know what I mean? So to go in there and to be able to get to a level to, you know, be competitive on a world stage, be one of the top companies on a world stage and grow, you know, in, you know, grow in year two and, you know, have talent, you know, have talent want to come. You know, I mean, that's another thing. It's like when you look at like, you know, Danielson is a perfect example. The guy could go anywhere he wants. And he
absolutely.
And, yep. And Danielson, you know, his decision was made as much. It wasn't a money decision. It wasn't like Tony offered him 10 times more and just felt, I need this guy and I'm going to, you know, whatever. I mean, it was like it was like he was going to make money anywhere he went and he was going to make good money. And he was going to, you know, at the end of the day, his decision was, where am I going to be happy? And this is with a guy who has family ties in the other company. So it made it very
tough. Absolutely, very true.
And the fact that he did this speaks volumes. It isn't like, you know, it isn't like he was a guy who they had decided over there, well, you know, for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent, he can't make it on our big stage because he's not good enough. Or there's something lacking in him, whether they're, and then sometimes,
no, absolutely not.
Sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong, but this is a guy who made it on the big stage and was a big star and could have stayed there easily and made that very difficult choice. So, I mean, I think that speaks volumes for a lot of what you created is the fact that, you know, people, you know, making a lot of money want to come because, you know, it's fun, you know, I mean, and that's, you know, you know, as good as anyone, you know, fun is probably more important than almost anything in life because, you know, you can have all kinds of money. And if you're not having fun, that doesn't make your life good.
It doesn't mean anything. No, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like you said, there have been a lot of projects in the past and maybe they've gone belly up and maybe they didn't work out, but it always starts from a place of passion. AEW is no different in that regard. We all had a passion for wrestling and wanted to bring something new to the table. And you combine that with just the right people, the right opportunities, and the right cast and players involved that could push this thing forward. And then, of course, you know, the elephant in the room, you need the money. You do need to
you need the money.
Be able, you know, you need a lot of it. And clearly, when it comes to passion for wrestling, knowledge for wrestling, someone who's lived it and enjoyed it, but has that money to make it happen, Tony's one of those guys. So,
Really. I mean, I've dealt with people who have started wrestling companies, and I mean, and some of them were wrestling fans to a degree, okay, but. Tony, you know, Tony as a fan is a different level fan than any of them. You know, I mean,
very knowledgeable. He's a historian. Yeah.
Yeah. He knows his history. He knows what's worked. He knows what doesn't work. He views it as a fan. I mean, he puts these TV shows together like he himself as a fan would want, as opposed to people who have and has a pulse of what the fans want. I mean, it's not always perfect, but nothing's ever going to be perfect. But,
right.
You know, I mean, it's like, he did, you know, somebody else could have been in that position and didn't have that kind of money to be able to be competitive at this level. So that was a big, you know, a big part of it. And you know, when we look back, as far as the start of this thing goes, so much of it is timing because it's like, you know, there was like 15 things, 20 things that all had to fall together that first year or there'd be no company. You know, I mean, it wouldn't have even started. I mean, and you know, you being a key part of that, the Young Bucks, I mean, it's like he had to be able to convince you guys not to go to WWE or not to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Because,
yep.
Because if he didn't have the talent to start, you know, it would have with mediocre talent, this thing would have had no chance, no matter how much money he had.
I've got no doubt in my mind that there are people on this planet who, if they were kind of given just a pad and paper and they said, okay, book your fantasy wrestling promotion. Yeah. They go, okay. Yeah, I got it. My main event player is going to be John Cena. My hardcore guy is going to be Mick Foley. my gimmick guy is going to be the Undertaker. You know, we'll have the Young Bucks there. Another big net. We'll put AJ versus Kenny. It's easy to do that, but you know, he needed the pieces and the ingredients for this recipe to create the, you know, the, the sort of baseline AW experience that would embody what he wanted to show and what he wanted to give the world out of professional wrestling. So it's, yeah, a lot of people becoming available at the right time when there was a demand for something a little different. We may never see that, or I might never see that again in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So
it's
cool to be a part of it.
And had the connection with TNT, because without the TV without the TV station, there's no business. You know, you couldn't do the business. So it's like, you know, he had to be able to convince a major station, you know, and of course the guy who was the head of the station was on board, but you know, you have to go in there and get a deal with a major station so that, you know, and convince them for sight unseen. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, the only tape is all, you know, all in from Chicago. You know what I mean? Which, you know, and that's the other one. That all in from Chicago, you know, when I look back at the history, and, you know, Cody's a big part of that one.
Absolutely.
You know, because he was, you know, him and the Bucks really spearheaded that show. All in Chicago, like if there was a question of, you know, like, you know, you went in there and you did 2,500 people after all that, does all this happen? You know, but you show a tape of, you know, to a TNT and there's 11,000 people and it's sold out and they're going crazy. And, you know, that, you know, a TV station looks at that and goes, there's something here. We may be on the ground floor of something. So it's like, but all of those things, you know, it's like, I, you know, you look back at that, you know, 2018, which set up 2019, you know, starting the company, but all that stuff in 2018, you know, I mean, so many of those things had to fall into place, you know, and Jericho, you know, was a really good person to have.
Absolutely.
To start out.
I would say Jim Ross was another good name for us in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Because there's that familiarity of them, which you guys didn't have at first, you know, and now, you know, I mean, look at, you know, again, it's interesting because Jericho has brought this up too. And, you know, they had a period, you know, of Kenny Omega, John Moxley and Chris Jericho, the first three champions, all out for various reasons, all at the same time. And they did well. I mean, granted, you know, you had Punk and Danielson come in and Adam Cole, which helped a lot. But you have taken, you know, the Sammy Guevaras and the Darbys and the Jungle Boys and the, you know, Santana and Ortiz and up and down the lineup. There's so many guys that nobody ever heard of that are out there. And, you know, we all know who they are. And you've, you know, because if you just went with the old stars, it's going to run. You know, at first people are going to, oh, you know, Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks and Adam Page, and they're all going to wrestle each other. And in 6 months, what are you going to do? And it's like it never that. I never thought that was the case, because you can always recycle and do matches. But, you know, you've been able to that's, you know, you certainly have not run out of matches, nor are you ever going to run out of matches with the deep roster that you have.
Yeah, I think it was kind of lucky that all of us were aligned in the beginning to put forth a selfless effort to make sure that even though we might be heavily lent upon in the beginning offset of the company, that we needed to have these stars developed for down the road. So, you know, Bucks and I took a lot of losses in the beginning. You know, Jericho was our first champion, but then he did his part of the process and put a lot of people over afterwards. And so In the case where we need to take time off or when we get injured because these things happen, there are people that are willing to step up, and they're believable because they've already gotten these huge wins over guys that were considered sort of the pillars of the company.
All right. I think that is it for now, but I always look forward to these interviews. Kenny, I find you extremely thoughtful, and hopefully we get to do another one again down the line.
Oh, we absolutely can. It's sure. Fun for me too. Thank you so much.
All right. So thanks again to Kenny Omega, and for Dave, I'm Garrett. To everybody, thanks for listening.